Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcy Winograd, a Los Angeles high school teacher who explains why there is growing support for her primary challenge to unseat hawkish incumbent Congresswoman Jane Harman. Author and climate activist Bill McKibben, who discusses the growing danger of global warming and a day of action on climate change he's organizing for October 24th. And Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who talks about his publication's 100th anniversary and a just-published book celebrating the many journalists and activists that have appeared in the Progressive's pages. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Lithium powers the batteries in over 2 billion cell phones and could provide the key to unleashing electric car technology. Currently, lithium comes mostly from mines in Chile and Tibet. Global production of lithium has skyrocketed by 40% since 2004. Bolivia has nearly half of the world's lithium reserves, located in an isolated arid region that is over 3,500 meters above sea level. According to the news magazine In These Times, the government of Bolivian President Evo Morales is working to develop lithium mining and wants European companies to build lithium battery factories in his country. After Morales came to power in 2005, he began nationalizing natural resources, including lithium. Bolivia's first lithium pilot project is set to open in January 2010, but the plant faces a number of significant problems such as poor technology, lack of water, and no electric, telephone, or internet service near the salt flats containing the lithium deposits. Moreover, some analysts have questioned the quality of lithium in Bolivia. Environmental activists have also raised concerns about the exploitation of lithium due to the long trail of devastation wrought by the nation's many other mining projects. When Sheila Holt moved back to North Carolina to care for her mother, she found it difficult to talk about her HIV status to friends or family members. Holt eventually qualified for Medicaid to pay for her 10 daily medications, but could never gain acceptance from a stepbrother, a half-time minister. According to the Los Angeles Times, southern states now account for nearly half of all Americans living with HIV/AIDS. To refocus attention on domestic AIDS, the Obama administration is spending $45 million over 5 years on television and radio spots to promote AIDS education and prevention. A recent study found states in the Midwest and the South, the most conservative regions in the U.S., received the least funding from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for Public Health, including HIV/AIDS. The 2006 renewal of the Ryan White Act on AIDS funding increased the flow of funds to the South. Still, AIDS outreach workers in southern states say the AIDS funding formulas are too focused on cities and ignore rural areas. Women inmates at the Mariana Federal Prison Camp in Florida found lots of dust on their clothing after working in a computer recycling facility run by Unicor, a company that runs technology recycling centers in 6 federal prisons. During the process of breaking up old computers, cathode tubes would often break, releasing lead and cadmium. Former inmate Tina Rosa told the Progressive magazine she remembers seeing layers of black dust on the floor and the inmate's clothing would turn black from the dust. Today, Rosa suffers from respiratory problems and is a plaintiff in a major lawsuit against Unicor involving inmates, guards and service workers at the Mariana prison. A computer can contain 5 to 7 pounds of lead. Inhaling modest amounts of lead can damage the central nervous system, kidney and blood cells. Exposure to high levels of lead can cause death. A recent inspection by health officials in a federal prison computer recycling shop found lead levels were 50% higher than acceptable standards and cadmium levels were 450% higher than normal. In 2008, federal inspectors closed the Unicor facility in Elkton, Ohio, citing high levels of lead and cadmium. Investigators found similar levels of toxic material at other Unicor prison facilities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Jane Harman, a seven-term Democratic congresswoman from California's 36th district, has long been the focus of progressive activists unhappy with her support for President Bush's Iraq War and warrantless wiretapping program. Harman, a member of the Conservative Democratic Leadership Council, has voted with Republicans on a number of economic issues, including the rewriting of legislation on personal bankruptcy and abolishing the estate tax. Press reports in April revealed that Representative Harman had, prior to the 2006 election, been overheard by a court-approved wiretap as she negotiated what appeared to be an illegal deal with an Israeli agent working with the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, a lobby group. She is alleged to have offered to pressure the Department of Justice to reduce charges against two AIPAC officials accused of violating the Espionage Act in exchange for AIPAC's effort to have Harman appointed chair of the House Intelligence Committee. But because Harman was seen by the Bush administration as an ally on warrantless surveillance, an investigation into her activities was halted. Now, Los Angeles high school teacher Marcy Winograd, founder of the L.A. chapter of Progressive Democrats of America, has announced her candidacy to challenge Harman in the June 2010 Democratic primary. After a short campaign in 2006, Winograd had surprising success, winning almost 40% of the vote against Harman. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Norman Solomon and candidate Winograd about why there is growing support for her attempt to unseat Jane Harman.
Well, Marcy's a longtime activist. She's a school teacher in L.A., somebody who has been very active since the beginning in the Progressive Democrats of America organization, which I'm also very active in. And back in 2006, she ran a very strong campaign against the incumbent, Jane Harman, and with just about 3 months of campaign time, racked up 38% of the vote, even though she was, of course, vastly outspent by the incumbent, Congresswoman Harman. So this time, Marcy, I think, has done it absolutely in an inspiring way, declaring her candidacy a full 12 months plus before the June 2010 California primary. And many people in California and elsewhere are mobilizing behind Marcy's campaign.
Marcy, thank you for being here tonight. Tell our listeners a bit about why this is your second time out now. As Norman has said, you were very successful in getting 38% of the vote against Jane Harman the last time. Tell us a little bit about why you feel this is so important to challenge her and to contest that seat.
Well, you know, I have to say that I wasn't initially going to run again because it is such an expensive undertaking and an exhaustive one. However, given the circumstances and what has come to light and the fact that so many who supported me last time have been literally, you know, calling and emailing and imploring me to run, because it does take someone with name recognition to challenge her in a way that's meaningful. And so many who have name recognition are elected officials, and they would never, ever challenge an incumbent. So I looked at the circumstances, and I looked at the possibility, the very real possibility of winning. And the fact that it seems like now is the time for change. You know, we voted for change. At least we voted for change. I don't know that we got change, but we voted for change earlier. And I think let's do it. You know, let's act on this. There's a groundswell. Jane Harman has been there for a long time and very, very accommodating to the aerospace industry, the military-industrial complex, which is really rooted in part of the district. And I think it's time for us to say, wait a minute. There must be another way. Let's expand this industry. We have this great brain trust in the center of our district. Why not retrain, retool some of these workers, the skilled workforce, the engineers, so that they can build rapid transit, so that they can build alternative energy industries that will sustain us over a long period of time and that will be more labor intensive and produce more jobs than military work does. So I said, you know what, I'm compelled. I'm going to do it. And here we are. We're off and running. We had our kickoff last week at Venice Pier, which is the northern end of the district. It's sort of a bohemian community. And it was wonderful. Great coverage in the district. And we're running. We're going.
Marcy, tell us a little bit about Jane Harman's voting record. What are the votes that Jane Harman has cast that disturbed you so much and has launched you into action, that has catapulted you into running this race again?
Well, some of them are votes and some of them are stands that she's refused to take. If we look at her voting record, you know, as Norman mentioned, she has consistently, except for on a few occasions, voted for war. She most recently voted for the $97 billion to escalate the war into Afghanistan. She was the ranking minority member of the House Intelligence Committee. She actually never got to be chair. That's what got her into some of this mess, because she wanted the Israelis to lobby for her to threaten to, reportedly threaten to defund the Democratic Party if Pelosi didn't make her chair. But she was a ranking member of that intelligence committee, and, you know, if she read the national intelligence estimate on Iraq, she never could have voted to authorize the invasion of that country in good conscience. My guess is that she didn't read it, or she didn't read it and take it seriously. So that's really egregious. On top of that, you know, she voted for the bankruptcy bill. Most people in this country go bankrupt because of medical bills, skyrocketing medical bills. She has refused to come out in favor of single-payer health care. A lot of people in her district are pressing her on that, and she refuses to do that. Keep in mind that she was, if Nancy Pelosi was briefed on torture, we know Jane Harman was briefed on torture. She was on the Intelligence Committee. She told the CIA not to destroy its tapes of waterboarding. So why would you tell them not to destroy waterboarding tapes unless you knew that torture was underway? Why didn't she stop it? Why didn't she take to the floor of Congress and stop it? For the same reason she didn't take to the floor of Congress to stop the wiretapping. That story, you know, has just been blown wide open. She was on the Intelligence Committee when all of this was going on, and according to the latest report in Congressional Quarterly, not only did she know about the wiretapping, but she went to the New York Times prior, on the eve of Bush's reelection, and said, and pressured the editor not to release the story about massive illegal wiretaps. The New York Times held back on that story, and who knows? Who knows what would have happened, how history might have changed had the American public known about what Bush was doing on the eve of his election, his reelection. In addition, she became, according to the Congressional Quarterly, she became the poster child for warrantless wiretapping when she made a deal with Gonzalez. You know, after this whole wiretapping of AIPAC, and this story is a bit convoluted, and I don't blame people who are listening if they're shaking their heads going, what, what? But in the end, at the end of the day, according to this Congressional Quarterly report, she made a deal. She went to Alberto Gonzalez, Bush's attorney general, said, get the FBI off my back, because apparently they had wired, you know, been part of this AIPAC wiretapping and gotten Harman on a wiretap inadvertently, saying that she would do whatever she could to get the charges dropped against the guys accused of espionage if they would defund the Democratic Party. So Gonzalez, according to Congressional Quarterly, said, okay, I'll get the FBI off your back if you do me a favor and you become the most ardent defender of our warrantless wiretapping program.
That was primary candidate Marcy Winograd, seeking to unseat Democratic Representative Jane Harman and Norman Solomon, author and co-chair of the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign. Visit the candidate's website at winogradforcongress.com. Writer and environmental activist Bill McKibben was the first author to write a book about global warming for a popular, not a scientific, audience. The End of Nature was published in 1989. Since then, McKibben has written often about the growing threat of climate change, and in 2007, he and half a dozen students at Middlebury College in Vermont, where McKibben teaches, organized Step It Up, a day for people to draw attention to the threat of climate change and to call on Congress to take action. 1,400 climate change vigils, teach-ins, rallies, and marches took place on April 14, 2007. Since then, McKibben was focused on the number 350, which represents the parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, above which life as we know it on Earth is unsustainable. Because scientists have confirmed that the Earth's atmosphere is already above the 350 carbon threshold, McKibben has declared an emergency and is organizing another day of action on October 24, 2009, to promote a strong U.S. position at the Global Climate Talks in Copenhagen this December. The following is an excerpt of Bill McKibben's talk delivered on April 3, 2009 at the Yale University Divinity School.
In December of this year, in Copenhagen, the world's leaders will meet and come up with the next big treaty on carbon. We used to think it would be an evolutionary document that would expand the Kyoto Accord some and include more. Now we know it has to be, given the science, a really transformative agreement. It has to not just be some agreement. They'll agree on something. You know, you don't get 880 heads of state in one place and say we failed. You know, they'll agree. But what we need is an agreement that actually gets us towards stability, that takes that number seriously. So we spent the last year at 350.org spreading that, building a kind of networks around the world. Wonderful, helping find and identify and work with wonderful networks like the India Youth Climate Network or many others all over the world, and starting some in places where there hasn't been this kind of thing before. We now have offices or sort of, you know, I mean, we work with young people. Most of my colleagues are all 23, so office is sometimes a sort of grand construction, but we have, you know, hubs of activity in Beirut and in Johannesburg and in Budapest and in Delhi and in Quito and, you know, and in San Francisco and Washington. And we've spent that year very profitably getting this out into the bloodstream of the kind of climate community, okay? Moving them some of the direction. So when Al Gore went to speak at the last big international negotiations in Poland in December, he gave the last speech of the week, and he gave his good, very good standard talk. And at a certain point, because we talked with him a lot, he said, and just as an aside, he said, and you know what? The old targets aren't good enough. We have to get to 350. And the place just erupted. It was like a minute of applause. And Al Gore sort of, you know, looking a little puzzled about why this is happening. We talked about it later. He said, yeah, that was pretty amazing. What had happened was that, you know, we'd spread the word effectively enough around that people understood that this represented a real change. This year, before Copenhagen, we now have to take the next step and make that into a very public movement, and that is where I need your help. October 24th is the day we picked for a day of global action on 350, okay? Because it's about 6 weeks before Copenhagen, and we need to take that most important number and make it the most visible number in the world. And there are going to be thousands of actions that day. We sent out the first letter about this 2 days ago out around the web, and we've already got 200 and some registered actions in 25 countries. That'll grow exponentially as the weeks go on if you guys help. There are going to be people high up in the Himalayas with banners. There's going to be 350 scuba divers on the Great Barrier Reef. We just found out that there's going to be a research team on Easter Island, and they're going to string banners from the noses of those stone gentlemen, you know, on and on and on. I need from you guys two things. One, to organize some of those sort of things where you are, okay? Here in New Haven or wherever you're from or through whatever groups and communities you belong to. And I need one other thing. Look, the odds on this fight are not especially good, it must be said, okay? We do have one possibility, one wild card, okay? And that's actually introduced by this technology that has spread in the last 15 or 20 years. If the internet came into being for a reason, it was to help right now, right here. If we took your email address books, and you all forwarded this message that we have up on the 350.org website, this letter, to 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 people with a little note from yourself at the top of each one saying why you thought it was important, okay? Well, not everybody who got it would open it, not everyone who acted on it, but if 10% of them did and then they forwarded it, we'd be halfway around the world before we knew it. That's the only possibility we have, is that kind of virality, and it is incredibly beautiful to watch it happen. You have to organize it and figure out how to push it and just take it and run with it. It's like a potluck dinner. All we're telling you is 350 and October 24th, and the rest is up to you. I've spoken completely frankly so far. I'm going to finish by speaking completely frankly. There's absolutely no guarantee that this strategy will work. In fact, there's absolutely no guarantee any strategy will work. It is possible that we have waited too long to get started. There are scientists who say the physical momentum of these systems is great enough that it's too late to meaningfully arrest them, and we're going to see it. The best science indicates that there is still a window of opportunity, albeit a narrow one, albeit closing. Right? Rajendra Pachauri, the Indian-born head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who accepted the Nobel alongside Gore, said recently, as far as he could tell from reading the data that they're getting, that if we haven't made fundamental changes, at least begun to make very fundamental changes in our energy system by 2012, the momentum of these things will be too great. That's the bad news. The good news is that all over the world, people are beginning to figure that out and beginning to step up. And much of it's coming from young people, but it can't come from young people alone. It needs to come from every kind of people. And you have it within you to help enormously in that process. And I hope very, very much that you will. And I thank you in advance for it. Thank you.
That was Bill McKibben speaking at Yale Divinity School about the danger of climate change. For more information on his latest organizing effort, visit his website at 350.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. One of America's enduring publications of the left is the Madison, Wisconsin-based Progressive magazine. The Progressive, celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2009, threw a party in its hometown in May, with speakers including historian Howard Zinn, author Naomi Klein, actor Robert Redford, and civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson. Among the musicians who came to Madison to sing the praises of the magazine were Annie DeFranco, the Indigo Girls, and Dar Williams. To mark its centennial year, the Progressive also published a book titled Democracy in Print, featuring articles and poetry written by some of the most influential journalists, activists, and artists who had appeared in its pages over the past century. The Progressive was founded in 1909 by U.S. Senator Robert M. La Follette, Sr. of Wisconsin, whose stated mission was to win back for the people the complete power over government, national, state, and municipal, which has been lost to them. La Follette attacked corporate greed, championed social and economic justice, and resisted war, a set of principles still upheld today. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with the Progressive's current editor, Matthew Rothschild, who briefly recounts the magazine's proud heritage and summarizes some of the prescient articles published over the last 100 years, many of which continue to provide insight and understanding on the political and social struggles being waged today.
Robert La Follette, Fighting Bob La Follette, as he's still called here, was a governor of Wisconsin and then a senator for many years, and he was one of the leaders of the progressive movement along with Teddy Roosevelt that everyone knows about. But Teddy Roosevelt was different than Fighting Bob La Follette. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive, but he was an imperialist progressive, whereas Fighting Bob La Follette was a progressive, but he was explicitly anti-imperialist, like Mark Twain. And so La Follette opposed Woodrow Wilson meddling in Mexico during the early 19-teens. He opposed Woodrow Wilson's entry into World War I, and for that he was almost expelled from the Senate. He was called a traitor. He was hanged in effigy. A judge said he wanted to try him for treason and then be the guy who pulled the trigger on the firing squad against him. So there was all this vile hatred of Fighting Bob La Follette. So he was opposed to U.S. intervention, and he was explicitly and adamantly anti-corporate. Those were probably his two biggest issues, and he called corporate power the central issue of the day, whether we were going to be governed by corporations or whether we were going to be governed by people, whether democracy would win or whether plutocracy would win. So that is a fight that we're still fighting today.
We're speaking tonight with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, which just celebrated its 100th anniversary, and a book commemorating that anniversary is titled Democracy in Print, The Best of the Progressive Magazine, 1909 to 2009. And I was struck again by so many echoes of the past reverberating and sort of relating to today's headlines. There's an article here from 1938 by Harold Ickes, then Secretary of the Interior, titled Lawless Big Business Must Be Controlled to Save Democracy. And isn't that right out of today's front pages?
Well, listen, and reading The Progressive in the 1930s, it was haunting because it was exactly the same arguments we're having today. Let me just read a couple sentences. Harold Ickes Sr., he was Secretary of the Interior in FDR's cabinet. He's the father of Harold Ickes Jr., who was a Clinton supporter and a labor lawyer for a while, but then definitely in the Clinton camp. But here is his dad, who was a little more radical than the son. Here in America, it is the old struggle between the power of money and the power of the democratic instinct. In the last few months, this irreconcilable conflict, long growing in our history, has come into the open as never before, has taken on a form and an intensity which makes it clear that it must be fought through to a finish until plutocracy or democracy, until America's richest 60 families or America's 120 million people win. And he goes on to talk about a capital strike that big business was planning against Roosevelt. They were planning just to stop producing unless Roosevelt rolled back the New Deal. And he said, if the American people call this bluff, then the America that is to be free will be a democratic America, a free America. But if the American people yield to this bluff, then the America that is to be will be a big business fascist America, an enslaved America. Wow, you don't have cabinet members talking like that anymore.
How has the Progressive survived 100 years? That's a landmark in any organization in this world. How did it happen, especially given the crisis in U.S. journalism, U.S. publications these days?
Well, we've survived for only one reason. We've survived because of the generosity of our subscribers. Actually, in 1910, Robert La Follette was passing the hat among subscribers, begging people shamelessly for contributions over and above the price of the subscription just to keep this magazine of dissent going. And that's how we've done it ever since. Actually, in 1947, the Progressive stopped publishing for a couple years, for a couple months, and the headline was The End of the Progressive. But the readers came to the rescue by sending in contributions, small and medium-sized contributions by the thousands, and so the magazine was able to resume, and we've been begging and borrowing ever since. We don't steal, but I'll get on the phone and I'll call people up for $50 or $100 contributions. I must make 1,000 of those calls a year, and we send out letters all the time asking people for money. It's not mail fraud. We really need the money. We don't have the money. And if people didn't respond, we'd be out of business in a hurry.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive magazine. Read The Progressive online at progressive.org. Democracy in Print, the best of The Progressive magazine, 1909 to 2009, is published by the University of Wisconsin Press. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.